TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Robert Fisk on Terrorism. In last week's program, the British journalist Robert Fisk spoke about the investigation of his paper, The London-Based Independent, into war crimes committed by the Israeli army in the refugee camp of Jenin in April of 2002. He spoke about a nurse shot dead as she came to the aid of a wounded Palestinian, a disabled man in his wheelchair run over by an Israeli tank, and another buried alive by a bulldozer under the collapsing walls of his home. Now you will hear about the response to these and other investigative stories and the limits to honest reporting overall. Robert Fisk has lived in the Middle East for 25 years. He has covered the war in Lebanon, the Israel-Palestine conflict, the Iranian Revolution, the wars in Afghanistan, the Gulf, and Yugoslavia. He is the recipient of 21 British and Foreign Press Awards and was chosen as Correspondent of the Year 6 times. He has probably also received more death threats than most other reporters. Robert Fisk begins by talking about terrorism. Who is being called a terrorist and why? Robert Fisk.
The international crimes against humanity of September the 11th may, I think, require a redefinition by those journalists, including myself, who normally abjure the word in Middle East reporting on the grounds that it is used exclusively about Arabs. But its overuse, almost as a punctuation mark in any discussion of the Arab-Israeli conflict, remains, I think, as poisonous as ever, possibly racist. It is difficult to explain to Arabs, for example, why the New York and Washington massacre was an act of terrorism, while the massacre up to 1,700 Palestinians in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Beirut between the 16th and the 18th of September 1982 has never been called an act of terrorism by journalists or governments. The death toll in Shatila was more than half that of the Twin Towers. Was this strange omission of the word terrorism because the killers, members of the Christian Flangist militia, happened to be allied to Israel? Did it not qualify as an act of terrorism, by Israel's own definition of the word, because most of the murderers were wearing Israeli Defense Force uniforms, albeit with the acronym Sahal obliterated? Or did it fail to meet the terrorism test because Israeli forces had surrounded the camp and because Ariel Sharon, then the defense minister, had sent the Falange into the camps? Not once, ever, has a Western newspaper called the mass murderers of Sabra and Shatila terrorists. Indeed, Israel's own Kahan Commission of Inquiry into the massacre, which held Ariel Sharon personally responsible for the killings, called the Falangist killers soldiers. You should read it again. This is not an isolated example. When an Israeli reserve officer, Baruch Goldstein, massacred 29 Palestinians in a Hebron mosque on the 25th of February 1994, he was not called a terrorist. CNN referred to him as deranged. Later, the Israeli ambassador in London said that Goldstein was deranged by fanaticism. Other reports spoke of Goldstein as an extremist. Yet when Hamas took its inevitable and wicked revenge with a bus bomb in the Israeli town of Afula, CNN recovered its nerve. Reporter Bill Delaney told us it was an act of Arab terrorism. Almost invariably, investigative reporting is rewarded with hate mail. When I got my hands on a UN-made videotape proving that the Israelis had a pilotless drone reconnaissance aircraft over Kana at the time of the massacre, a drone with live-time picture capability, which the Israelis originally said did not exist, it meant they could have been seeing it and did know what was happening. The first item of mail to arrive on my desk from London began, "I do not like or admire anti-Semites." Here we go again. "Hitler was one of the most famous in recent history. You are a disgrace to a profession that should report the news." The easiest way out of this problem for many journalists, I fear, is to distort the coverage so that events which are unfavorable to Israel, however dramatic, are buried deep in the story. Just 5 days before the Kana slaughter, and most people have forgotten about this, an Israeli pilot flying an American Apache helicopter fired an air-to-ground missile at an ambulance packed with women and children in southern Lebanon. The Israeli army stated, wrongly, as I discovered after weeks of investigation, that a Hezbollah fighter, a terrorist in Israel's parlance, of course, was in the vehicle. I used the computer-coded markings on the exploded missile parts. We actually had to pull parts of the missile out of the bodies of the children and the women. I traced these parts back to its origin, a Boeing factory in Duluth, Georgia. The story of the missile, which was initially sold to the United States Marines, taken to Saudi Arabia for use against the Iraqis in 1990, and subsequently given free of charge to the Israelis, along with another batch of the same rockets, was later reprinted by Harper's in New York. Yet not a single American news outlet tried to follow it up. Far sadder was the American coverage of this little atrocity involving the ambulance, another massacre. Like most other papers in Europe, The Independent front-paged the story. In the latest and most terrible of Israeli attacks on civilians, an Israeli helicopter gunship yesterday fired a missile into an ambulance, killing four girls and two women on board, The Independent reported. This at least conformed to the usual style of journalism school, which American would-be reporters often attend, unlike their British opposite numbers. The most important part of the story goes in the first paragraph. Or so you'd think. But for some strange reason, the New York Times didn't think so. Serge Schmerman, writing for the Times on the 13th of April, 1996, began his story like this. This is the day after the killings in the ambulance, which he has to report on. Here's his intro. Israeli gunboats blockaded Beirut and other Lebanese ports today, and Israeli guns rained shells on southern Lebanon as Israel steadily raised the heat of its operations against Islamic guerrillas. Paragraph 2 begins, Israeli commanders noted that the guerrillas of the Party of God, the Iranian-backed organization also known as Hezbollah, fired only a few Katyusha rockets into northern Israel today. Where, you may ask, have the deaths of the four children and two women gone? Only in paragraph 6 did Schmerman suddenly mention the rocket attack. In the deadliest incident today, an Israeli helicopter fired a rocket into an ambulance. There then followed a comment from an Israeli officer who claimed wrongly that the vehicle was being used to carry a Hezbollah guerrilla. Schmerman devoted twice as much space to Israel's justification for this terrible attack as he did describing the victims. I still ask myself why the New York Times should have shown such a serious distortion in its news values as to relegate what by its own admission was the deadliest incident of the day to paragraph 6. It's ironic that among the exceptions to the grotesque and misleading journalism coming out of the Middle East are a few brave Israeli reporters who question the morality of Israel's actions with a ruthlessness and a determination that is rare in any European publication and almost totally absent in the United States. Among the most courageous and eloquent of these is the work of Gideon Levy and Amira Haas in Haaretz. If you don't read them, you should. Haas told me a few weeks ago, when we were chatting together, that she believes the duty of a journalist is, and I quote, to monitor the centres of power. As good a definition as I've heard ever for our profession. But it raises an important question. How can Amira Haas say things which her American counterparts shy away from? How can Amira Haas report on the cruelty of Jewish settlers and the immorality of Israel's shooting of child stone throwers, as well as the corruption and brutality of Arafat's regime, when far better paid and supposedly more powerful American journalists cannot, at least not without the weasel words that immunize them from criticism? Back in 1993, I made a three-part documentary film for the Discovery Channel called Beirut to Bosnia, which attempted to find out why an increasing number of Muslims had come to hate the West. We filmed in Beirut, southern Lebanon, Israel, the occupied West Bank and Gaza, Egypt, Bosnia and Croatia. Among many stories we filmed, we followed the last and hopeless attempts of a Palestinian farmer to hold on to his land. We also reported the aftermath of Sabra Shatila. We visited the former Acre home on our film of a Palestinian refugee in Beirut, now owned by an Israeli Jewish family. And we travelled to Poland to find the house of the elderly Israeli who had seen in Acre, who had been driven from his own original home and his parents killed by the Nazis in 1939. Shortly after the series aired on Discovery, a series of pro-Israeli lobby groups, including Camera, the Camera Media Resources Centre, known no doubt to some of you, who bombarded the Discovery Channel with complaints. Joseph Ungar wrote to complain that for me to say that Israel confiscates or occupies land and builds, quote, builds huge Jewish settlements on Arab land, all facts acknowledged by Israeli and international human rights groups, as well as foreign correspondents for many years, was, quote, twisted history. To say that the Falangist militia had been sent into Sabra Shatila by Israel, as the Kahan Commission report makes perfectly clear, was, quote, an egregious falsehood. Discovery rang me in Beirut to say that they were receiving, quote, lots of letters condemning the films from various groups. American Express had helped to fund the series. It cost $1 million altogether, lasted 3 hours. And American Express cards came back to Discovery cut in half. Then director, I can't think of a better thing to do with American Express cards. Then director Mike Duckfield and I heard that Discovery had cancelled a reshowing. Interestingly, the condemnation and abuse I regularly receive, far outnumbered, I should add, by literally thousands of letters which praise the independence coverage of the Middle East, particularly from my colleague Phil Reeves in Jerusalem, has increased significantly since The Independent became available through its website, www.independent.co.uk, to internet users throughout the world, especially America. One email to our paper said that American readers lamented their own what he called lobotomized journalistic coverage. A number of letters of support came from American Jewish readers, several from Israel. Then, of course, last May, the Hollywood actor John Malkovich told the Cambridge Union that he would like to shoot me. Almost anyone who criticizes US-Israeli policy in the Middle East now is in this free-fire zone. My own colleague in Jerusalem, Phil Reeves, is one of them. So are two of the BBC's reporters in Israel, along with Suzanne Goldenberg of The Guardian. And take Jennifer Lowenstein, a human rights worker in Gaza, who is herself Jewish and who wrote a condemnation of those who claim that Palestinians are deliberately sacrificing their children. She received the following email. Bitch, I can smell you from afar. You are a bitch and you have Arab blood in you. Can we journalists ignore the abuse in the lobby groups and the attempt to soft-pedal our reporting about the Middle East? White House spokesman Ari Fleischer's remark last October that, quote, the press is asking a lot of questions that I suspect the American people would prefer not to be asked or answered, carried its own ominous implications. CNN boss Walter Isaacson's instruction to staff that it seems perverse to focus too much on the casualties or hardship in Afghanistan because it ran the risk of helping the Taliban was perhaps the most shameful journalistic remark ever to come from a media head. I want to just divert briefly before I finish, because it involves the Middle East, it involves all of us. What has been happening to us in the months since September the 11th? You know, we spent decades preaching to the Third World, to China and the Soviet Union, to Black Africa, and yes, to the Arabs too, about law, democracy, human rights, fair trials. But the moment our glittering towers were struck, we tore up all those old lectures, imprisoned hundreds on suspicion, brought prisoners drugged and blindfolded to Guantanamo Bay, bombed the poorest country in the world, and killed thousands of its citizens. In any ordinary crime, even domestic crime, the first thing the cops do is look for the motive. Yet when this most terrible of crimes was committed last September, no one was allowed to look for a motive, save for the preposterous theory that the killers destroyed so many lives because they didn't like democracy, something they've never experienced in their lives anyway, or our success. Oddly, the killers themselves were not from the deprived. I visited the home of Ziad Jarrah, the Lebanese suicide pilot, who came from a village in the Bekaa Valley of Lebanon. This was the pilot of the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania after the passengers, with in immense courage, stormed into the cockpit. Jarrah's parents were middle class, his mother a schoolteacher, his father a civil servant in the Lebanese government. They desperately wanted to believe that their son was an innocent passenger on the plane. His father, as I interviewed him, wept in front of us, because of course he knew the truth. His son had a girlfriend, a Turkish girl, who was to have met his parents last summer before their engagement was announced. In the end, she travelled alone to meet them, a very strange arrangement in Lebanon, because Jarra suddenly announced he was too busy with flight training in the States. You bet he was. His father sent him $2,000 3 days before September the 11th. And on the 10th, Ziad Jarra rang his parents in Lebanon to thank them for the money. I suspect it was used to buy airline tickets. It later transpired he'd been to Afghanistan for 6 weeks. He'd been non-political before. However, as a boy, he'd been trapped in Beirut by the 1982 Israeli invasion, spending weeks there under shell fire. Had this touched him, as it did so many others at the time, or had he forgotten all about it? The police, the security authorities, cannot deal with the motives. It might turn out it's America's presence in the Gulf, hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children dying under UN sanctions supported by the United States, something perhaps to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It can't be looked at. So what has the United States administration done? It has prevented, effectively, two of the axis of evil countries, Iran and Iraq, plus Syria, of course, from having visas, and those who do get visas will almost certainly be fingerprinted and interrogated upon their arrival in the United States. Oddly, there isn't a single piece of evidence connecting citizens of any of those countries to September the 11th. There's an awful lot of evidence connecting them to Saudi Arabia. 15 of the 19... 15 of the 19 suicide killers came from Saudi Arabia. But the Saudis can get their visas. They're not in the axis of evil. They're not in the fantasy world, you see. They won't be fingerprinted or interrogated. There are problems there, aren't there? Was the world really changed forever by September the 11th? I don't think so. Perhaps America was changed forever. But why should the world be changed? I told you of the 17,500 people who were killed in Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982. I talked about Syria, 20,000 killed in 1982. But no one lit candles for them. There were no church services here. No one remembered, and the world did not change. I heard Colin Powell telling us from Louisburg University last fall. I was in Pakistan at the time. He said, "Never again can we look up into the pale blue sky and see an airliner and feel the same way about it." Well, I think this is nonsense. I look up every day from my home in Beirut and see airplanes in the pale blue sky. They land at Beirut Airport. And I fly on a lot more planes than Secretary Powell, and they all land at my destination, including San Francisco, safely. You know, without in any way belittling the horror and the evil of that terrible day, and you'll forgive me if this seems offensive, I do sometimes wonder whether America's concentration on that one day, to the point where we cannot even discuss motivation, isn't becoming a form of dangerous self-absorption. So a final question. Can we really go on depicting the tragedy of the Middle East through a distorted lens, where illegal colonies are settlements, then just neighborhoods, where we pretend that occupied land is merely disputed or war won, where the Israeli siege of a Palestinian town becomes a closure, where Arab victims are killed in crossfire, where a man held responsible for a massacre is called a warrior? I'm thinking here of Ariel Sharon's autobiography title. Or even a pragmatist, courtesy of the New York Times, where Lebanese prisoners held in Israeli jails are to be called bargaining chips rather than hostages, where uncomfortable atrocities are pushed into the sixth paragraph, and where a Holocaust is downgraded to ethnic cleansing. You know, we journalists have to suffer the sticks and stones. All we have to do is risk the crossfire and remember the whys and tell the truth. Or, as the old American maxim says, we should tell it how it is. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
That was a talk by Robert Fisk, war and Middle East correspondent for the London-based Independent. After a standing ovation, he answered questions from the audience. And here are two that elicited most interesting responses. First, a young woman asked about the environmental cost of war. Here is Fisk's answer.
If I was to think of the one thing which is a great danger, it's depleted uranium. I've spent weeks in southern Iraq going around the hospitals, children's hospitals, particularly in Basra, Nasiriyah, and other cities. I've seen babies born with one eye, no ears, no lips, no mouth in one case. I've seen vast numbers of people without any history of cancer in their families on their deathbeds in filthy hospitals. I went out once to the area of the battlefields where the last Gulf War fighting took place. It's strewn with the hulks of Iraqi T-72 tanks, which of course all were hit by A-10 munitions or American tank fire using depleted uranium warheads. Depleted uranium is made out of the waste products of the nuclear industry. Constant research has shown that the aerosol spray emitted by the explosion of the warhead, the reason why Western armies use it is that it emits such a heat that it just eats its way through the armor and explodes inside the tank and kills everyone inside. Many of the people dying of cancer in southern Iraq are from this area. It's actually not desert. It produces strawberries. There are animals grazing there, some wheat, and they're eating it and drinking the streams that flow through it. When I was out looking at one of the tanks, an old man came up to find out what I was doing. And I told him, and he said, "Ah." And I said, "Well, what are you doing?" And he said, "I've just been to bury my young daughter. She's just died of cancer." "Any history of cancer in the family?" "No." Then we know that NATO used the same kind of munitions, American aircraft at any rate. British tanks fired depleted uranium as well in the Gulf, but American only, in Bosnia in the 1995 bombing of Serb targets. And a large number of refugees, before they fled their home at Hadići, which is near Sarajevo, Serbs in fact, were very close to the bombing of a Serb military truck park where depleted uranium munitions were dropped. I've actually been there and seen the DU rounds on the ground. I traced about 300 of these refugees, who are now living refugees once again, on the Drina River in eastern Bosnia, close to the border of Serbia. One was a little girl who admitted to me that she was much younger then. She was about 5, I think, who says that when she was playing afterwards, she would pick up pieces of the metal, put mud around it, and pretend it was patties. Well, now she has no fingernails, no toenails, and big wheals down her face which bleed. Of the 300 Hadići residents whom we could find a trace of originally moving in, 100, one-third, have died of cancer in 5 years. Again, this is not a story that gets a lot of play over here. One reporter on the Boston Globe some years ago couldn't get it into the Boston Globe, so he had to have it reprinted in a European newspaper. We constantly go back to this, and we track down people who've been in the area of DU. There is a great deal of suspicion that it's been used in Afghanistan, although the Pentagon totally and repeatedly deny this. They say there have been no depleted uranium weapons used in Afghanistan. Of course, it could be that since depleted uranium is not a weapon but part of a warhead, there's a little bit of dickering with the language there. Economy of the truth, as our politicians in Britain like to say. I just don't know.
After September 11th, the administration of this country began what it calls the war on terrorism. And I'm wondering if you'd assess for us the relative safety of American citizens as a direct result of the war.
That's the nastiest question I've ever been asked in the United States. Well, first of all, it started, remember, as a crusade. Then it became a war for civilization. Then it became a war against terror. Then it became a war of good against evil. Like the interim state, it goes through a kind of chrysalis process before you can really be sure what it's about. I'll tell you a little tale. My father was much older than my mother, and he was a soldier in the First World War. He was born in 1899, in the century before last, and fought in the Third Battle of the Somme in 1918. When he died in 1992, the year before that film was made, I inherited his campaign medals from the First World War. And the one of which he was proudest when he wore it was a gold coin attached to a ribbon. In his later years, he felt great bitterness that he was sent to the First World War. He said it was a place of Armageddon and blood and fire and hate. And I think he regretted that he wasn't born later, which would have given him the Second World War, of course. But on the back of that gold coin on his campaign medal is engraved the words, "The Great War for Civilization." That's partly my answer to you. Are you safe? Well, I probably would have said you were before September 11. I do believe that the safety of America depends on its behavior abroad. The safety of America... The safety of America, I believe, depends upon it following its own interests, not those of other countries abroad. It depends upon a genuine neutrality in foreign disputes. And I don't think your country exercises those restraints. And I think as long as alliances and friendships and economic interests go in front of justice, any country that does not put the right values first is always going to be at risk from very wicked people, but people who nonetheless are able to find a market for their views on injustice in the world. So I think it's to do with your foreign policy.
That was a response by Robert Fisk to a question from the audience, recorded in June of 2002 in Berkeley, California. Robert Fisk is an award-winning journalist and foreign correspondent for the London-based Independent. This was the conclusion of a talk on the recent political history of the Middle East, on the Jenin refugee camp, and the question of terrorism. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Robert Fisk and the Independent on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get a copy of the full 1.5-hour speech by Robert Fisk by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.